It's 3 o'clock here on KTOO Gino, and good afternoon. I'm Matt Miller in for a Gino afternoon for today. And coming up in this show, or today's show, we'll have a preview of Saturday's Empty Chair Memorial Project concert. Also, we'll find out more about the family-to-family support group. Senator Vic Fisher and Constitutional Convention delegate will stop by to talk about his new book. And also, we'll have more on arts and entertainment in the capital city with Nancy DeCherney and Arts Up. All that and much more, including Writer's Almanac and some music. That's all coming up in the next hour. Forecast for the capital city calls for some rain for most of the day today. High temperature about 37 degrees. A little bit of rain tonight, some snow likely. Along with that rain, low temperature about freezing.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Census Bureau has released a report on Native poverty rates across the United States. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports, the numbers are not encouraging.
Federal guidelines put a single person making less than $11,170 a year or a family of four with an income below $23,050 in poverty. Nine states have more than 30% of their Native populations at or below those poverty guidelines. South Dakota tops the list with 48% of Natives considered poor. The state is home to some of the poorest counties in the U.S., including Zeebot County on the Cheyenne River Reservation, which is the nation's poorest. South Dakota's second largest city, Rapid City, has a nearly 51% poverty rate among Native residents. State demographer Mike McCurry says most of South Dakota's poverty is centered on the state's nine reservations. He adds the federal numbers aren't surprising. The 5 years of data collected by the government show Arizona, Maine, Minnesota, Montana, Nebraska, New Mexico, North Dakota, and Utah as other states with large percentages of Natives in poverty. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
With the possibility of nationwide budget cuts around the corner, an analyst says the Indian Health Service, which serves nearly 2 million Native Americans and Alaska Natives, could be heavily impacted. As KUNM's Christine Trudeau reports, the health agency is already dealing with an underfunded budget.
The term sequestration refers to nearly $1.6 trillion in automatic reductions to the federal government's budget across all programs in what's being called the equivalent of an economic suicide vest. Through political pressure, the measure has been touted as a way to force a compromise in Congress to lower the national debt. But short of an agreement, across-the-board spending cuts would take place on March 1st. Currently, Indian Health Services is funded at around one quarter of actual need, and urban Indian health centers receive about 18.6% of financial need. Policy analyst Jay Steiner with the National Council of Urban Indian Health in Washington, D.C. says sequestration would significantly impact the Indian Health Service's ability to provide program services to both tribal and urban clinics.
Sequestration would be disastrous for the Indian Health Service as well as for the urban Indian health programs, which are funded by the Indian Health Service. If nothing is done between now and March 1st, sequestration will implement across the board 8.2% cuts to the Indian Health Service and the programs that are funded within it.
The Indian Health Service currently employs around 5,500 clinical staff across the nation. For National Native News, I'm Christine Trudeau.
Indian artifacts have been found in a New Orleans, Louisiana neighborhood. The Times-Picayune reports archaeologists under contract to the Federal Emergency Management Agency have discovered pottery, animal bones, and pipes near Bayou St. John. It's estimated the items are more than 1,500 years old. Surveys are being done under agreement with the State Historic Preservation Office and tribes. The find is said to be exciting historians and others as it represents some of the only intact prehistoric remains of its kind south of Lake Pontchartrain. The history of the area includes the site of an Indian settlement, French, Spanish, and American forts, a hotel, and amusement park. When the field tests are finished, the artifacts will be analyzed and recorded. The first tribal and bilingual newspaper published in the United States turns 185 years old. The first edition of the Cherokee Phoenix was printed on February 21, 1828, in New Echota, Georgia. It was printed in English and Cherokee using the Cherokee syllabary. Today, the paper is published in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, and circulated nationwide. It also has a website featuring multimedia pieces and a radio show. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, with funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use Pick Click Give when filing online for your PFD. When you select KNBA-FM, Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, you support National Native News. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're listening to Juno Afternoon here on KTOO Juno, and I'm Matt Miller sitting in for today. And with us in the studio is Steve Tata, Alice Hikito, and Margie Shackelford from the Empty Chair Memorial Project. And you folks have an event coming up this week, I believe, that is kind of a benefit for the project. And Margie Shackelford, let me ask you, what is the Empty Chair Project? Can you tell me a little bit more about it?
Well, it's basically to do with the Japanese internment during World War II. I have a really good friend, Mary Chinaka, and we grew up together here in Juneau, and it wasn't until we were like in our 50s that I discovered that she and her family had been interned during the war and sent to Minidoka for 3 years of their lives. And we had been around to look at other monuments and other places, and in my mind, you know, it was such an injustice, I thought it needs to be recognized. We can't necessarily, you can't take it all, you know, we can't always redress everything, but we can at least acknowledge that an injustice occurred. And so I'd like Alice to tell the story of the empty chair, because her brother was the person, the story about the empty chair involves her brother.
Okay. But first I wanted to ask you, any idea how many families or how many people out of the Juneau area, for example?
There were around 42 people that were taken away, yes.
And how many eventually returned after World War II?
Well, our family was the only family unit that returned. There were other bachelor men that did return also, but we were the only family. We chose to return back to Juneau after the war was over. And in that return, I just want to express, you know, our family's gratitude, because we received such a welcome to come back. We had support from people that when we came back, we were able to stay with before we could move back into our house. My father had to start his business all over again. He had to take a loan out from the bank. And the bank gave him the loan unconditionally. And suppliers were family friends that told my father that he didn't have to pay his bills until he had a cash flow that made it possible. And, of course, we wondered if the customers, my father had a cafe, and we wondered if the customers would come back. And, yes, they all came back. So we really felt, my father was tremendously gratified by that support when we came back, because the 3 years we were away, almost 4 years, you know, we really were objects of, you know, for one thing, we were interned and we were identified with the enemy when we were not the enemy at all. We just physically looked like the enemy, but we were not.
How old were you at the time?
At the time, I was 9 years old, and I came back, I was about 13 years old, so I have some pretty good memories. Yeah, you think when you're 9, you're pretty young, but I have very strong memories at the time.
For example, what kind of memories do you have of being?
Well, when the war broke out, the FBI came to our house and searched the house. This was the day after Pearl Harbor. Took my father away. You know, we didn't know what was going to happen to him. They didn't really tell us, but anyway, they took him up to the federal. There was a federal jail in town because Juneau was the capital. And they took all the men, actually. It wasn't just my father, but all the immigrant-born men. And then shortly after that, they were taken away from Juneau. We didn't know where they were going to be taken to. So there's a lot of unknown, and we didn't know what was going to happen to us either. But in the spring, and then April, the following April, all the women and children were also taken away in turn in a different camp. My father was in... sent to a camp in Santa Fe.
And where did you go?
We went to a camp called Minidoka in Idaho, and that was where we spent the duration of the war.
Did you have any contact with your father while you were separated?
Yeah, we were able to correspond by letters, but always his letters were censored. So he couldn't give us any real specific information. But when he was reunited with us, he was released to Minidoka in 1944. And at that time, he told us everything what had happened from the time that he was taken away from us, you know, after Pearl Harbor, where he was, you know, what type of treatment and what type of, you know, things happened to him. So, because he also had a hearing. They had a hearing in Juneau also after he was picked up. So he was able to tell us about that hearing, which was really quite interesting.
What was it like for you? And can you tell me a little bit about the conditions at the camp that you were at?
Well, the Minidoka camp had 44 what we called blocks, and each block had 12 barracks. And we had a common mess hall that we ate in and, you know, common laundry room. And our family of, I have two older brothers, a younger sister, and myself and my mother. My father was, of course, away from us. And we shared a room that was probably it was a small room that we shared with a potbelly stove. And that was our home for the duration of the war. And then we had all our meals in the mess hall, did all our showering and bathroom needs in what they called the laundry room. So it was kind of a communal kind of a living. And everybody was in the same boat. So there was a certain sense of community that formed within the camp, naturally. But because we had to feel, you know, supportive to each other. But, you know, we always longed to return to home. That was our desire and dream to do that.
You remember harsh conditions, or was it just minimal conditions?
Well, we were never ill-treated physically. That never happened to us. We were guarded by soldiers and guards. We were inside a barbed wire fence. But, you know, we had adequate food, adequate shelter. It was like an incarceration, like you were jailed. You lost your freedom.
And she was only 9 at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll get back to you in just a second. But Steve Tata, you're third generation Japanese American.
Yeah,
is that right?
That's right. Yeah, my dad was born in Seattle and grew up there, and so did I. And my grandfather, who came and immigrated through the Portland area first and then moved up to Seattle. 1895 was actually his date of entry. So that was quite a while ago. Our family goes back quite a ways. And kind of in a coincidence, my uncle was here in the late 30s during the Depression years working at the Taku Cannery. And he was a summer slimer. And so we have kind of a Southeast connection. I remember when I told him I would be moving to Juneau, he gave me a big chuckle and said, "That's the most expensive place to live in the U.S. And he was partially correct.
Did they tell you any stories about their experiences of being in the internment camps?
Actually not. My father never did. My aunt, who would have been his younger two sisters, mentioned certain things. They had little photo albums, they had little mementos of the Minidoka camp. They published, ironically, they published what was called a memory book of it, and it looks like, you know, the Minidoka interlude, and it has group photos of everybody's family in front of their barracks, and it's really quite an austere book, although it kind of reads like a school yearbook. I mean, they had social clubs, had tried to have dance bands, and, you know, and morale builders, and they even had Boy Scout troops.
That's true.
Which is quite an irony to be to be having. I didn't know what kind of civic merit badge that you would get, you know, in an internment camp. But no, it was never really brought up. And I really do think that, you know, my dad just wanted to get along and get on with his life. He didn't want to burden his, you know, the next generation with any of this.
A chapter that he felt was behind him and he needed to step up and move ahead of it.
I can't speak for him, but I would assume.
Yeah, I think that's very true. People wanted to, they lost 3 or 4 years of their lives, and they really wanted to move forward, leave it all behind and move forward. So a lot of the internees, they really didn't talk too much about it after they left.
I really didn't know about Mary's experience until after we'd been friends for 50 years.
Oh, okay. So you're of course, a Juneau resident for quite some time.
Yes, so I was born here.
Oh, okay.
Okay, Mary and I were both born here.
And so when did you find out about the connection?
Well, the first time I found out about it was when we were in college. It was a story Mary had written that I read coincidentally about, in which she mentioned feelings I never knew she had about being Japanese. And then later on, as time went on, we started going to some of the memorials in other towns and started talking about it and her family's experience, and I just learned more and more and more. I did want to cover why it's called the empty chair.
I was going to move to the LSE kiddo here. Yes, you had a story about why this project is an empty chair.
The empty chair is called the empty chair. Yeah. The empty chair is really a symbol. You know, when the war broke out, I had an older brother who was a senior at Juneau High School, and is actually... The graduation was going to be held in May, and we were interned in April. We were taken away in April. Before we were interned, though, the high school did have a kind of a ceremony, a student body ceremony, where they gave my brother John his diploma. When the actual graduation took place in May, they kept an empty chair on the stage for him to recognize that, you know, he was not going to be there, that I think they even announced that he was in the internment camp, and that was the reason why the chair was empty. So the chair is kind of a symbol. Mm-hmm. It's a symbol of the absence of the total Japanese community that was taken away because of the situation. There was a executive order by President Roosevelt that took all the Japanese Americans from the West Coast, 120,000, and put them in internment camps. So our Juneau community was just a small part of that.
Now, this project is scheduled or is planned for near the Capitol School, this empty chair memorial?
Yes.
And what's the timeline for this?
We're very hopeful. We have an artist, Peter McQuam, who designed the chair for us that we wish to place in the park, and we're hoping that it'll be there by next July. Not this July, but July of 2014.
Is it going to be bigger than life size?
It'll be 1.5 times life size, and we're hoping the mountain will be the backdrop, and you'll be able to see the channel and where the ships might have come in.
Is there going to be any other features to it, like names of?
It will have the names of the. It will be sitting on like the floor of the gym, floorboards, and there will be the names of all the internees etched on it, plus a symbol for remembrance in Japanese. And a Japanese symbol for remembrance and memory, and, you know, a text telling the story of the empty chair.
Now, Steve Tata, you have, I just woke you up here. You're participating in this benefit for this project, right? Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about what you have planned.
Okay. Well, Saturday night at 7:30 at Northern Light Church, I will be performing a violin and piano duet concert. Nancy Nash from Haynes will be my accompanist, and she'll also be playing a couple of short solo pieces on her own as well. It's a very nice program. Classical romantic composers, the well-known Schubert, Brahms, and Clara and Robert Schumann, husband and wife composing and performing duo from the Romantic era, approximately 1880s, 1870s. There is one piece that's going to be a little bit different, and when I was approached to ask to play this, I started to think what might be an appropriate, maybe traditional Japanese piece or something that would tie into the Japanese American Memorial or the Empty Chair Memorial. So I found a piece that was originally written for koto, which is the Japanese zither. Has many, many strings. It's by a man named Miyagi. And he lived in the early 20s in Japan, and he was quite a famous composer. He wrote this piece called The Sea in Springtime, Haru no Umi, and it became quite a well-known piece. And actually, he was a he went blind at a very early age. I think it was age 6 or 7. And he ended up luckily being able to study with a great Koto master. And he received the name, the title master himself by the time he was in his mid-20s, which is quite exceptional. And he was quite a prolific composer and wrote many popular songs that that anyone, I think, in Japan of a certain generation might immediately know his name, like, you know, like you would say Stevie Wonder, you know, or, you know, he was like the Ray Charles of his time, and certainly everybody would know a tune by him. And so that's going to be kind of the standout different piece on the program.
Okay, and once again, where and when is that going to be?
7:30 is the concert, and it's Saturday at Northern Light Church.
Okay. Margie Shackelford, Steve Tata, and Alice Hikito, thanks a lot for coming by. You had one more thing you wanted.
There's one more thing I wonder if I could add. You know, this coming Sunday on the February 24th at the Downtown Library from 6:30 to 8 p.m., there's going to be an empty chair panel discussion. And at that time, we'll be giving a little bit more information about the whole subject.
Oh, okay.
So we invite the public to come to that. I think it'll be very interesting.
6:30 to 8 at the Downtown Library, Saturday.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, no, not Saturday, Sunday.
Sunday, I'm sorry. Okay.
That's all right.
Thanks very much for coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From B's Bakery and Bistro, offering homemade baked goods, lunch items, and paninis Tuesday through Friday from 7:30 to 5:30, and weekends from 9 a.m. to 3. B's Bakery and Bistro, located downtown on 2nd Street.
After 3 o'clock, and with us in the studio right now is Rabbi Dov Gartenberg. Do I have the pronunciation of that name?
That's right.
Okay. And you're from NAMI, which is the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. Is that correct?
NAMI Juno, as we call it.
And what is a little bit about that? Can you tell me a little bit about that organization? What's that about?
Sure. National Alliance for Mental Illness is a national organization, and it is based in Washington, D.C., or in the area around Washington, D.C., but there are affiliates really in every community in the United States. And Juno is a very distinguished affiliate. We've been here for more than a decade and been involved in helping advancing support and education about it, support for mentally ill and education about mental illness and advocacy for the mentally ill in our community.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about some of the services you may provide.
Well, we offer classes, I'll get more specific in a moment, for people with mental illness, or actually support groups for people with mental illness. We also provide support for families that have a loved one with mental illness in both an educational context through classes and also with support groups. Because often the brunt of the challenge of helping someone with a mental illness falls on the family, and it's quite a challenge. I know it about it personally because I've as a parent I experienced that. But that's our main effort and mission is to provide support, education, and advocacy for those with mental illness and those who are close to them.
And is it just kind of the whole gamut and whole range of what may be considered mental illness?
Well, we do cover the whole range. There are several severe mental illnesses that we focus on, such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, borderline personality, conflict, post-traumatic disorder, anxiety disorders, and depression. So we've had in the past support groups for the people dealing with those issues and for their families.
Are financial considerations, is that normally a hurdle for people to participate in?
What's really important to NAMI is that our programs are free. So we are funded by the State Mental Health Trust and also through donations in the community. And that allows us to offer these programs to the community for free, and they're open to the public. So we already have over 10 people signed up for the family-to-family class. Let me say something about that. A family-to-family class is a curriculum developed by the national organization. It's taught everywhere around the country. It's won many awards. It's an overview in 12 weeks of different types of major diagnoses, treatment, all the issues of navigating the mental health and behavioral health system, advocacy for your loved one, and also dealing with the tremendous stress and challenges that a family may run into in helping support a loved one with mental illness. But it's very comprehensive, very popular. That's our classes starting next Wednesday on the 27th at the Family Birth Center.
And it sounds like it's just kind of a basic primer for somebody who may be wanting to get up to speed or has a loved one and they're trying to help them deal with their own illness.
Well, think of it this way. You go to, say, a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a therapist, and you're having a session with them, whether you're someone who's struggling with an illness or you're a family member. They're helping you, but they're not educating you. They're not giving you information. They don't have the time to give the information in the therapeutic hour. So what we do is really give people information and resources to help them find the best treatment possible and the best approach possible. So that's the key uniqueness of NAMI.
Now, are these sessions, these classes, and you may have mentioned this earlier, but is this something that kind of rotates and repeats on a regular basis?
We offer family every two times a year, in the fall and in the winter spring. So this is our winter spring series. We also are starting a family support group, which is not a class, but it's a group support group run by peers. That is, people who know the situation, they're going through it, and who've been trained to help facilitate groups. So say you're a family that has a loved one with mental illness and you want to find what other people are doing, how they're handling it, how they're dealing with the stress, how they finding connections in the community, this is really ideal. And that starts Thursday night, the 28th. You can see, if you can go to our website at www.namijuno.org, and that has the classes are listed there, or you can call me at 463-4251, and I can tell you all about it.
It could be a lot of comfort in realizing that you're not alone and that people have already navigated this path that you've probably tried to embark on, right?
I'll give you an example of my life twice. I went when we had a young child who was acting strangely, a baby, really, a toddler, and we went to a parent group and found out that our child had autism. The doctors went to were all very, very hemming and hawing and not saying anything for various reasons, but it's actually at the support group that we learned that our child had autism and then found the people who were dealing with other issues. And that was one child, and later on, when an adolescent with mental illness, Again, the same thing happened. Going to the support groups with NAMI, in this case in Seattle, helped us find all sorts of approaches and support and relief in dealing with our son's challenges. And he, thank God, is doing great now. And, you know, really through that support, these groups can be very, very, very important for families on this very unique journey.
Okay. And once again, you mentioned the web address, www.namijuno.org, and the Family to Family and the Family Support Group, those are coming up next week?
Right. Wednesday is the Family to Family course or class at 6 o'clock at the Birth Center. But call me and I'll get you set up and signed up for it. It's free. And then the Family Support Group, which is led very ably by two community members, Colleen Jones and Patty Germain, starting Thursday night on the 28th. It's actually meeting at the synagogue, Congregation Beth Sukkot Shalom, at 7 o'clock. And that's both are free. But just let us know that you want to come, and we'll get you signed up, and you can participate.
Okay. Rabbi Dov Gardenberg from NAMI, thanks a lot for stopping
Thank
by.
Thank you very much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 21st of February, 2013. It's the birthday of Anais Nin, born in Neuilly, France, 1903, studied psychoanalysis, was a patient of Carl Jung at one time, wrote in obscurity for most of her life until her diaries began to be published in 1966, diaries that were written over a period of 60 years. It's the birthday of W.H. Auden, York, England, 1907, son of a physician, went to Oxford on a biology scholarship, switched to English literature. He met poets like Cecil Day Lewis, Stephen Spender, Lewis McNeice, who became his lifelong friends, and just before the start of World War II, emigrated to the United States to teach English. It was on this day in 1925, the first issue of The New Yorker came out, founded by Harold Ross and his wife Jane Grant, a reporter for the New York Times. Ross, the editor-in-chief, until he died in 1951. In the second issue, the editors published an apology for the first one. They said there didn't seem to be much indication of purpose, and we felt sort of naked in our apparent aimlessness. Circulation had dropped to 12,000 by the fall of 1925, but then it started to turn around after Ross hired E.B. White and James Thurburn. Gradually, the magazine stopped dropping famous names and developed its own sensibility and style in short fiction and essays. It's the birthday of the novelist David Foster Wallace, born Ithaca, New York, 1962, author of Infinite Jest, which became a bestseller in 1996, even though it was more than 1,000 pages long with 100 pages of footnotes. Wallace battled devastating depression his whole life, committed suicide in 2008. His unfinished novel, The Pale King, published in 2011. He said, "Postmodern irony and cynicism has become an end in itself, a measure of hip sophistication and literary savvy. Few artists dare to try to talk about ways of working toward redeeming what's wrong because they'll look sentimental and naive to all the weary ironists. Irony has gone from liberating to enslaving. The postmodern founder's patricidal work was great, but patricide produces orphans, and no amount of revelry can make up for the fact that writers my age have been literary orphans throughout our formative years." Here's a poem for today, a poem by Charles Bukowski, entitled Number 6. "I'll settle for the six horse on a rainy afternoon, a paper cup of coffee in my hand, a little way to go, the wind twirling out small wrens from the upper grandstand roof, the jocks coming out for a middle race, silent in the easy rain, making everything at once almost alike, the horses at peace with each other before the drunken war, and I am under the grandstand, feeling for cigarettes, settling for coffee. Then the horses walk by, taking their little men away. It is funereal and graceful and glad, like the opening of flowers. Number 6, a poem by Charles Bukowski, from Burning in Water, Drowning in Flame, published by HarperCollins and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org/mobile. Produced by Kathy Roach and Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 3:36, and you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on KTOO, and I'm Matt Miller sitting in for today. And with us in the studio is founder of ICER, state senator and constitutional convention delegate Vic Fisher. Good afternoon.
That's a delight to be here, Matt.
Thanks for stopping by.
It's my pleasure.
First of all, before we get anywhere, I'm sure you've probably heard the news about your friend's wife, Jean Rogers.
Yes.
passed away recently. As kind of sad. What do you think of when you think of Gene Rogers?
Well, I've known Gene Rogers since the early 50s, so we were friends for about 60 years. I worked with George Rogers over many decades, and I would call up. I'd come to Juno, and I'd call up and say, is there any room at the inn? And they had a slew of kids in those days, in the 50s and 60s, and there was always a bench in the living room. The benches went around the windows, under the windows, and there was always room for another person. And I had lots of dinners and breakfasts with them, and they're just fabulous people. And Jean was mother hen to taking care of all the kids, and she was an artist in her own right, singing and doing artwork, and just a real participant in the community and a very good friend, just a very loving, warm kind of person.
Now, they both were heavily involved in the local art scene, from what I remember.
Very much so, very much so. They sang, they acted in plays, and they were in opera and the choir, and they active in church, and sort of wherever the community provided opportunities or needed somebody, both Jean and George were there.
Now, what brings you to Juno for this week?
Well, I was invited by University of Alaska Southeast to come and participate in be one person in a series of arts and a series that where they asked me to talk about my new book called To Russia with Love, an Alaskan Story. And so that'll be the theme tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Egan Hall on the Auk Lake campus.
And you also have some other events planned for today and Saturday, if I remember right, that focuses on the Constitution and the Constitutional Convention?
Right. Today at 5 o'clock in the Betty Farron Camp Room, on the second floor of the Capitol building, there's a forum to talk essentially about the Constitution as a highlight in the 100-year legislative history of Alaska. And then on Saturday, there's a book signing at Trinity Church, and that's going to be also at 7 o'clock Saturday night, and there'll be a talk as well as book signing, and there'll be tomorrow at UAS will be a talk and book signing.
Well, let me ask you the obvious question here. What made you decide, or why did you decide to put down your life story in a memoir?
I lived a pretty fascinating life, starting out in Russia and Germany in the 1920s and 30s, then came to the U.S., served in the Army during World War II, and came to Alaska and got very involved in statehood and constitutional convention professionally, both as a planner and in politics in the early years as well as in the 1980s in the state Senate. And I had a beginning in Russia, and then I had was very active in connection between Alaska and the Russian Far East after the ice curtain melted between Alaska and the Russian Far East and Siberia. And that was happening in the late 1980s. And I sort of got in the middle of things and was able to use my Russian and knowledge of Russian history and politics and the economy and so on. And during the 1960s and 70s, I was director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research. And during that time, I established ties with the Academy of Sciences in Russia. And so we had a lot of scientific, social science relations during that early era, and then picked up again. And plus, one reason for writing is that there are lots of stories, and I would always tell people stories, and they'd say, oh, you've got to write this up. And eventually the time came, I got old enough, and with Charles Woolforth's assistance, we worked on it for 3 years, and the book got done.
There were probably a lot of challenges in tracking down records and people involved over 70, 80 years or so. How did you and Charles Woolforth go about in fact-checking this book?
My father had written an autobiography when he was in his early, mid-40s. My mother wrote a book called My Lives in Russia that told about the era of when we lived in Russia in the 20s and 30s. There was a book written called The Troika. It was published in Germany. And the book was written by a Stasi, German secret police general, who was the older brother of one of my best friends in childhood. And it was about the three boys, the three musketeers, the Troika, who just did everything together as kids. And then during the war, we were in three different armies, one in the Russian army, one in the German army, Hitler army, and I was in the American army. And then we reconnected, and there are just threads like that. In the early 1990s, I reconnected with my Russian classmates from the 1930s, those who are still alive. So they're just a lot of stories and a lot of things that people enjoyed hearing. And so in terms of material, there are also archives at Princeton that had hundreds, probably thousands of folders of correspondence and other material going back for many, many decades, correspondence between within family, with other people. And so we went through books, through articles, through other histories, and a phenomenal amount of correspondence. And I had a lot of files in the University of Alaska archives, so we went through much of that. And the biggest job in getting this book done was holding it down and not having a 1,000-page book come out of it.
Well, you write a little bit about the people who were taken away and disappeared during the Stalin's purges and the paranoia that seemed to be everywhere at the time.
It was fear more than paranoia. Mm-hmm. It may have been paranoia on Stalin's part, but in terms of the parents of my friends, there was fear. The children were fearful because so many were disappearing around them, family members, friends, neighbors, and so on.
And it was parents fearful of their children, and children fearful of their parents because nobody knew who was going to tell somebody about what was about.
Right. And kids didn't talk to parents, and people just couldn't trust anybody around them.
Did you have? I know you write in a little bit about this in the book, but did you have a sense as a young boy about actually what was happening at the time?
I mentioned there were three of us, three boys. We were close enough. We dared speak to each other about what was happening. We were became very aware when our heroes who had fought in the Civil War in 1920-21 in Russia, and our heroes were now being arrested and executed, summarily executed by Stalin's NKVD, their KGB secret police, and we just saw this all around. Our neighbor, next door neighbors, were arrested. They'd come for them at 2 o'clock at night. It was a scary time, and you'd hear these boots coming up the steps, and it was just very close and very aware.
Any surprises from the research that you and Charles Warforth did that began to make sense about you or your parents or your two friends as you wrote this book, things that you now know that may have had an impact on you or shaped you as the person you are now?
Well, very much so. I learned a lot because I knew some of the events going on around me, but we had interviews with a lot of my classmates talking about their situation. So there are little profiles in the book about what was happening with them, going into detail of who was arrested and who was executed, and in one case, the father was executed, and they took the mother and sent her off to prison, to the gulag, and then the daughter, my classmate, was arrested also and also sent off to Siberia. And these stories, I knew that father had been executed, but I didn't know about the rest of the situation, and that didn't come out, to my knowledge, didn't reach me until the 1990s. So, I mean, there were a lot of stories discovered, and I learned a lot about the political situation of more recent years, as well as what went on in the 1930s and other periods.
You write extensively about your father, Louis Fisher.
Yeah.
He was a famous journalist at the time, and he comes across as kind of cold and distant, I guess literally and figuratively, although you did have the form of a father figure with Paul Massing.
Right.
Did that shape your own attitude or behavior toward your own family, or I mean, was that for the better or for the worse?
Well, it was for the better. I'm an optimist, and I can twist almost anything toward the better. But Paul Massing was just a very humane figure in my life. He was like a second loving father. My natural father was driven. He was very self-disciplined. He was always working and writing as a journalist, reporting on Russia, writing books, and it was sort of difficult family life because we had to be, my brother and I had to be quiet and not disturb him, and he was not sort of the friendly, playful type as Paul Massing was.
So did you, when you grew up and got older, did you try to emulate Paul Massing and his behavior and his attitudes with his family?
I would say I did not try and emulate. I think by nature I was more akin to my mother than my father, and sort of there was a lot of warmth in the household for my mother, and a very sort of socially conscious. And of course, my father was also, he was very freedom loving. He was anti-imperialism, and he sort of stood up for democracy and independence for India and other countries.
One more question, and I wanted to ask you about your mother. And I'm to the point in the book where it sounds like she's being essentially blackmailed or coerced into joining Soviet intelligence or working for them in exchange for yourself and your mother and your brother escaping Russia. How did you find out about that?
I found out about it when I read a memoir that my mother wrote after her book was published, where she described being called in by the KGB, the secret police, and they interrogated her about who she spoke with and whom she visited and so on, and she knew that the KGB types, the police, knew exactly what was going on because phones were tapped and they had other people reporting to them about with whom they had conversations and whom they saw, to the point where people wouldn't meet each other. They didn't talk to each other anymore because they knew the secret police was always on top. So they were checking on her, and they'd call her out for midnight or post-midnight interrogation. And in the process, and at that point, my mother had applied to leave Russia, and she was a Russian citizen, and they wouldn't give her a permission to leave. They wouldn't give her an exit passport or a visa, but they'd call her out to the visa office, and then they'd refuse to give it to her. And so these KGB people tried to blackmail her into becoming a spy for them, that essentially they would let her leave the country if she would report on people in America, in Europe, and so on her friends. And she just said no, that she wouldn't do that. And so she was, month after month, she was refused permission to leave until they both got desperate. My father contacted the president's wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, whom he had met already, and she talked to Franklin Roosevelt, who said, yes, do what can be done. And about 2-3 weeks later, we were out of Russia.
But was she still working for Soviet intelligence at that
point. No, she refused to kowtow to them.
Okay, so the relationship didn't last. She made it out without having...
Right. They called her out, and she was scared that she could be arrested and exiled any time. And it was just that her husband was an American, and there were lots of Americans who perished during that time, but he was pretty famous during those years, and they'd rather have her become a spy, and they would also ask, why doesn't Louis write about Russia anymore? And he had quit doing that and discussed with the Stalin regime.
Well, Vic Fisher, we're out of time, unfortunately. I'd love to talk to you some more, but you're gonna be back tomorrow, and you're going to talk with Pat Moore. And then coming up today, you have that appearance at the state capitol, which is at the Educational Forum, the Farron Camp Room in the Capitol, the Alaska Constitution. That's at 5 o'clock. And then tomorrow's event at Egan Lecture Hall on the Auk Lake campus about your book, To Russia with Love and Alaska's Journey. That will be at 7 p.m. Thanks a lot for coming in.
It's been a pleasure, Matt. And books will be available tomorrow at the UAS event. There'll be a book signing.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, it's 2 minutes before 4 o'clock, and with us in the studio is Nancy DeCherney with
Bobby Lewis and Eustace Johnson.
Oh.
These are the gospel singers, and I just want to say we only have 2 minutes, so the thing that you need to know first of all is that 11 o'clock on Saturday is a special as-you-can rehearsal, dress rehearsal, because we're sold out on Sunday at 2. We'll get people in. And I think we're about sold out at 5:30, right?
Yes.
Right. So, but I mean, we will try to cram people in. But this is the Gospel Celebration group that was here last year, and it's fabulous. Don't miss it.
Very popular last year, wasn't it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's singing in the choir this year.
We only have 108 people in the choir this year.
You know, it's very, very powerful and moving. And I want to just say, if you, I'm not going to have time to go through the whole list. We've got Oliver. We've got Annie. We've got Theater in the Rough opening up this week on Thursday. There's a soul food dinner on Saturday. Go to our website and pull up the thing. And I will post my weekly thing that I usually read through here for you.
Oh, okay.
Because we're just not going to be able to get through everything.
It's a long list. Busy weekend, right?
It is. It's a four-pager.
Oh, sheep. So an hour wouldn't have been enough then.
No, we would have made it through, but I would have been talking really fast. Anyway, like I said, Oliver, Thunder Mountain, Annie, the musical is at the JDHS. We've got our gospel stuff going on all weekend. There is a Wild and Scenic Film Festival that the Juneau Watershed is doing at the Jack. The family one is at 4, and at 6:30 is the sort of more general one. That's a fundraiser. There's the Masquerade Ball, the Rotaract fundraiser at Rockwell. I mean, it goes on the Empty Chair Benefit Concert.
Have you heard about that?
Okay, good. So it is a very, very busy pack. There's the dance, Lee Oderholt International Dance, Folk Dance Workshops all weekend at the Filipino Community. What else we got? It's just kind of an amazing week, and Arts Roundtable on Monday. I don't miss that. Anyway, I didn't want to...
Okay. Well, thanks for a lot for coming by anyways.
Like I said, I'll post this thing on the website.
Sure.
But don't miss the gospel thing. Please try to come to that. It's 11 o'clock on Saturday and on Sunday at 2 and 5:30.
Okay, and you're listening to KTOO Juno. It's 4:01, and coming up tomorrow on a Juno afternoon, Vic Fisher will be back. Also, storyteller Tom Cosgrove will be in.